I'm Rick Dedarian, and you're listening to Realms of Memory. The history of Mexican Americans is one of broken and forgotten promises. The Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo that ended the U.S.-Mexico War in 1848 was supposed to extend full citizenship rights to the roughly 100,000 Mexicans who ended up on the U.S. side of the border. Omar Valerio Jimenez, professor of history at the University of Texas San Antonio, reminds us that this promise was never kept. His research and publications chronicle the struggles of Mexican Americans for full citizenship rights. His first book, River of Hope, Forging Identity and Nation in the Rio Grande Borderlands, looks at how Mexican Texans took up this fight in the second half of the 19th century. His most recent book, Remembering Conquest, Mexican Americans, Memory and Citizenship, which will be the focus of our conversation today, extends this story to the entire Southwest from the U.S.-Mexico War to the 1970s. Omar, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity to speak about my book.
Just how different are the U.S.-Mexican narratives of the U.S.-Mexico War?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I discuss in the book is, you know, in many ways, the U.S. version of the war is going to blame Mexico for the war. Various diplomats who didn't accept, you know, for example, the U.S. offer to pay them for, you know, to purchase land, you know, that belonged to Mexico. Mexican politicians are going to blame the U.S. for invading and for starting the war, for provoking the war by invading what at the time was northern Mexico, which is today southern Texas. So, you know, at the very outset, you know, of you know, looking at any conflict, right, like whether it's the U.S.-Vietnam War or the U.S.-Mexican War, each nation is going to have their own view of the war, their own perspective, and they're going to be very different because they're going to blame each other, right? So, that's the foundational thing that I realized right away. And, you know, I have nieces who have studied in Mexico, and they say the same thing. They say, you know, we get very different versions of what happened when we study this conflict in Mexico than when they then came to the U.S. They were born in the U.S., but they left for a while while my brother worked in Mexico. They studied there, got very different views of the war. And I describe one of these episodes in the introduction as well of my book. And then they came to the U.S. and they were also sort of presented with the U.S. version, which is very different. So I think, you know, this is not unique to the U.S. and Mexico. As I mentioned, it also happens with other wars. But in the case of U.S. and Mexico, one of the things that I think is interesting, at least for my case, because I study Mexican-American history, is that Mexican-Americans are sort of caught in the middle. They're the human consequences. They suffer the human consequences of this conflict. Just like, say, Vietnamese Americans who ended up fleeing Vietnam, they're part of the human consequences of that conflict.
And so clearly Mexican Americans have their own memory of this past, and that's the focus of your book. And to what extent have those memories been incorporated into either the Mexican or U.S. narratives of the war?
Sure. So I think they haven't been incorporated very well. So if you look at textbooks from both nations, it was only until recently that they began discussing what effect the war had on Mexican Americans, on the former citizens of Mexico who became U.S. citizens because they lived in the territories that were annexed by the U.S., that were taken over. Territories like the states of Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and California, for example. So, you know, the U.S. version of the war, for example, emphasizes that the conflict resulted in the acquisition of a vast amount of territory, right? It made the U.S. a continental power. In Mexico, the national memory of the conflict focuses on the nation's loss of territory and the wounded national pride that resulted in its defeat. So the collective memories of the war and its human consequences have really been kept alive mostly by those mostly affected, and those are Mexican Americans. So for Mexican Americans, in many ways, the enduring truth of the war has been that some of them, you know, the scholars and activists who specifically study the war and who make references to the war, think about or describe the long-term human consequences of the war as an unending war. These long-term consequences can be summarized as the second-class citizenship that began in the mid-19th century and continues to reverberate into the present. And, you know, various civil rights groups make reference to this. They say, you know, our second-class citizenship began with our incorporation into the U.S. or the incorporation of our ancestors into the U.S. in the mid-19th century.
But there are actually hundreds of memorials. I don't know if there are museums that recount the history of the conflict on each side of the border. I mean, is there any place for the memory of those people who get caught in between?
I think there is. But it's very, how would I say this? It's very sparse. You know, I looked at memorials of, you know, and monuments in the U.S., for example. I examined databases that have a list of some of these monuments and plaques that are in historical markers in various places. And very few of them mention the war. And when they do, they mention, you know, just the battles and what happened. But they don't necessarily focus on the consequences, the social, economic, and political losses that Mexican Americans suffered after the war, because they stayed. And so they lost property, they lost political power, they lost land, they lost, you know, social status and such. So that is oftentimes, it might be mentioned that so many, let's say, they might say 100,000, about approximately 100,000 former Mexican citizens became Mexican Americans because they lived in, you know, in these states, but they're not going to mention all the different consequences necessarily. I think if you have, say, a community center in, say, California or Texas who has a temporary exhibit, they might have it, you know, on the war, for example. I've been to some of these exhibits, and they are going to explain sort of the Mexican-American version of the war, right? But I wouldn't necessarily expect to see it, and I haven't seen it in major museums in the U.S. or Mexico. Mexico does have a museum of foreign interventions in Mexico City. And I haven't visited that museum, but I imagine that they probably mentioned the war, obviously. But I'm not sure they're going to discuss, you know, these individual episodes of what happened to Mexican Americans with their loss of land, their loss of political power, and social status.
Okay. So if we're trying to grapple with the fallout of the war for Mexican Americans, just how far-reaching is it? You mentioned a few things already. What's the impact? To what extent does it really affect people?
Sure. So I think one of the reasons I decided to divide my book into this analysis of several generations, and it's five generations, right, from beginning in the conclusion of the war until the 1970s, is to sort of track sort of generational how each generation, or scholars and activists in each generation, how they thought of the war and how they strategically remembered the war. And by that, I mean how they remembered the war to press for certain, in my case, what I discovered was that they strategically remembered the war to press for certain civil rights or to press for certain political ideas of reform that they had. And so what I believe and what I found is that there isn't one sort of view of the war among any generation. So even the first generation of Mexican Americans, you know, who lived from 1850 and from the 1850s to the 1880s, for example, they are not going to have a uniform vision of the war. Some of them are still going to have hopes, for example, that they can be socially and politically and economically integrated or accommodated into the U.S. into the new U.S. government and new U.S. society. And some of them are going to very, very quickly learn that that's not the case. So some of them hope for accommodation. Some of them attempt accommodation. Some of them flee and decide this is not going to work. We're going to flee. We're going to go to Mexico. We're going to cross the new international border and make our lives in Mexico. And then some of them resist militarily, you know, and armed resistance. And I can discuss this later, as well as politically. They try to organize into sort of political parties, or I wouldn't say parties, political factions, perhaps, and try to assert their rights in that way. But it's what I found is, you know, in my book, by tracing these five generations, is that the war is central, and specifically the treaty, because the war was the way that the U.S. acquired all this land. You know, approximately half of Mexico's territory was lost to the U.S. as a result of the war. And it was the way that the first Mexican Americans were incorporated into the U.S. and became citizens by the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. So the treaty that ended the war is called the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. And in that treaty, they, you know, both governments agreed on what the new international boundary was, what their responsibilities were in terms of trying to enforce that new international border, the new international boundary, and also what kind of rights were going to be given to the former Mexican citizens who lived in these territories from Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and California. And so one of the things I explain in my book, and other scholars have explained, is that this treaty created the first Mexican-American generation, because it was these former Mexican citizens became U.S. citizens, and yet they were ethnically Mexican, so they were the first Mexican-Americans. They were also the first Latinos incorporated into the U.S. The second group would be Puerto Ricans after 1898. And then after the Spanish-American War, and after they eventually obtained citizenship several years later. So Mexican Americans also have the distinction of being the first sort of what today we would call a non-white group to be given U.S. citizenship. They were given U.S. citizenship before Native Americans, obviously before African Americans, before Asian Americans. And because they were given citizenship, U.S. citizenship in 1848, at the time, the laws on the books, there was a law called the 1790 Naturalization Act. And that law said that the only people who could become citizens, who become naturalized citizens, were whites. And so by law, by the treaty, Mexican Americans were declared legally white. But in reality, you know, depending on where they lived and their social status, their economic status, they were mainly treated as non-whites. But in some cases, in case of elite, wealthy individuals, wealthy Mexican Americans, they might have been accepted more as whites. So anyway, I make this point that, you know, and other scholars have made the point that Mexican Americans were the first sort of what we would call ethnic minorities who were sort of considered white, at least legally, although socially they were not.
So there's this common kind of reference point to the treaty that was supposed to extend citizenship rights, that there's this shared memory of injustice, of loss, but you can't really talk about a Mexican-American memory. It's too diverse of a community that you really need to look at specific times, at specific groups, at specific places to really get at different ways in which those memories are recalled and put into service for present uses.
Exactly. And for contemporary uses, because I think not just today, but, you know, in the late 19th century, the early 20th century, the mid 20th century, different civil rights groups, Mexican American civil rights groups, or different scholars, different journalists would recall the treaty for different purposes. So yes, and many times the way they recalled it had a lot to do with where they lived. For example, you know, in my book, I discuss how the people who lived, the Mexican Americans who lived in New Mexico, much of their memory of the war and of the treaty was focused on trying to obtain statehood. because New Mexico, unlike Texas and unlike California, did not become a state, you know, in the mid-19th century, shortly after the war. Instead, New Mexico didn't become a state until 1912. So it took years, decades for it to become a state. And so during those decades, during those close to, I think, six decades, politicians in New Mexico, scholars, journalists would often, you know, advocate for statehood. And they would advocate for statehood by recalling the treaty, and that the treaty promised that Mexican Americans would be incorporated into the U.S. And they believed that they weren't completely incorporated because they didn't have the rights of a state, and they couldn't elect their own representatives. They couldn't elect senators or representatives to represent them in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, that part I thought was fascinating. So you could get this treaty that extends citizenship rights, but if you don't have a state, that might not mean a whole lot. And I think you point out in the case of this area that what becomes New Mexico and Arizona, maybe Colorado, that all the top level positions were appointed positions.
Exactly.
And even though that seems to be the center of gravity, that most Mexican Americans are living in New Mexico. That's mm-hmm. So on the one hand, they're concentrated there, and they've got a lot of influence locally that doesn't exist in other places that gives them influence. But at the top levels, they don't have it.
Exactly. They don't have, they can't even elect their own governor, right? It's an appointed position. So they have, you know, they have some power to elect local officials, mayors and city council people. But they don't have the power to, influence, basically elect their governor, or even the laws that they pass are subject to the approval of Congress, because they remain a territory until 1912. So several generations of Nuevo Mexicanos or New Mexican Americans who live in New Mexico suffer from this sort of, in a way, disenfranchisement. You know, in the sense that they don't have rights as state citizens.
So early on, they're going to use their past strategically, in this sense, to try to gain this statehood status.
Exactly. They're focused on gaining statehood, and they do eventually in 1912 gain statehood at the same time that Arizona gains statehood. And so the territory of New Mexico is much broader than what the state of New Mexico is today. So it includes Arizona, you know, in the 19th century, for part of the 19th century.
So to me, it seems like if forgetting is happening, at least it seems to be a lot more of it going on. There's a lot more selective remembering happening in the area of New Mexico.
Yes. And one of the things, I'm glad you're bringing this up about selective memory and selective, you know, forgetting, selective remembering, because one of the things I also want to discuss, and, you know, this is perhaps an aside, but I think this is a common pattern among various generations of Mexican Americans, regardless of where they lived, which is they often, you know, civil rights activists, scholars, journalists will often, you know, cite the treaty, discuss the war, the U.S.-Mexico war, and say, you know, the U.S. never lived up to its promises in the treaty. It never really enforced its citizenship, the citizenship guarantees that they made to us, right? And therefore, there's an injustice here, right? And we lost land, you know, through various processes. You know, we lost economic power, we lost social status, we lost political power. But one of the things that they neglect to mention, most of them, is that their ancestors, you know, the Spanish and Mexican colonists who ended up arriving in places like New Mexico and Texas and establishing Spanish and Mexican towns and cities, they took part in the conquest as well. They conquered local Native American groups. They waged wars against these groups. They did not think of Native Americans as equals, just like Americans did not think of, you know, European Americans did not think of Mexicans as equals. And so they selectively forget that their ancestors were also, you know, part of a conquest of a, you know, a settler colonial conquest in many ways. And, you know, various scholars, Mexican-American as well as Native American scholars, have made this point. But I just, I like to make this point in the book because, you know, when these scholars and activists are saying, you know, the U.S. did not live up to its ideals and, you know, they conquered us and they did this and that, that's all true. But we should also remember that our Spanish and Mexican, you know, ancestors took part in a conquest that, you know, disenfranchised and plundered Native Americans from their ancestral lands.
Okay. And this is a forgetting that, really stretches from the mid-19th century all the way to the end of your book, to the 1970s.
Oh, yes. Yes. And it continues today. I mean, there's activists today who conveniently ignore that our ancestors took part in this conquest.
But what I thought was fascinating was that at least New Mexicans really wanted to emphasize their European background.
Yes.
They really wanted to try to push that to try to further the cause of statehood and even certain ways of the self-designation, which I never really had, I didn't have that understanding that the Hispanic title
right.
was a way of emphasizing your Spanish roots.
Yes. And let me explain that. So one of the things that, you know, and I'm going to say this is a little different than today's use of Hispanic, right? So New Mexicans or Nuevo Mexicano started using Hispano or Hispanoamericano in the late 19th and early 20th century, partly to try to emphasize their Spanish roots. And the reason they did that more so than people living in Texas or Mexican Americans living in Texas or those living in California is because they were focused on obtaining statehood. And what they wanted to show was that they were white. They wanted to show, they wanted to emphasize their whiteness, their Europeanness, because they believed that was part, and they were right to believe that that was part of the reason that Congress, various congressional representatives and senators opposed statehood for New Mexico, because other states who had lower populations of, you know, European Americans or people who might be considered, let's just say, lower populations of non-Indigenous people had already obtained statehood throughout the 19th century before New Mexico obtained statehood. So they were focused on saying, we're white, we've had a long history of civil government, and we deserve statehood. And their opponents said, no, they were opposed to that for various reasons. One was that they thought that they were non-whites, that New Mexico was a non-white territory, but also because of the pervasiveness of Catholicism. They were afraid of what would happen if there was a large group of Mexican Americans, a large group of people who were Catholic, who basically obtained statehood, and because of their numbers, they were the numerical majority, obtained power, in, you know, more power, electoral power in New Mexico. So there was, you know, these fears. And as I mentioned, you know, the New Mexican residents of you know, Mexican descent, los Nuevos Mexicanos, started this sort of campaign to sort of emphasize their Spanish ancestry and sort of de-emphasize their indigenous ancestry because they were mestizo. They were, you know, a mixture of both Spanish and indigenous people.
Hmm. So did you have Catholic Americans that were rallying to the cause of statehood for New Mexico?
Well, I would say that there were definitely some politicians who believed that New Mexico, some non-Mexican politicians, you know, people, European Americans who lived in other states, not in even in the Southwest, who believed that New Mexico deserved statehood, right? Whether they were Catholic or not, I'm not sure, but I imagine some of them were, and they obviously thought this idea that the idea in the mid-19th century, and it was directed against Irish Americans as well, right? Irish immigrants, that they should not be allowed to vote, we should be careful about their voting patterns or their voting preferences because they were controlled by the Pope, right? Because they were Catholic, it was this sort of anti-Catholic bias, very very sort of xenophobic in many ways. That was also applied to, you know, Mexican Americans.
Okay, so if you want to put a spotlight on the failure of the treaty to be implemented, the failure to consider at least in the case of New Mexicans, as being white. Then you want to stress their Europeanness, and so you've got to kind of forget the mixed nature of those populations. So you've got to exclude the mixing that went on between Europeans and indigenous peoples.
Exactly. Yes, and they basically didn't emphasize that at all, even though I'm sure they knew, they obviously knew that they were of mixed ancestry. They mainly emphasized their Spanish ancestry. And this occurred throughout the Southwest. So it wasn't just New Mexicans, but New Mexicans, because of this, you know, focus on statehood, it was more apparent there. In the political debates, it was more apparent in newspapers and so forth. But there's other populations in California, as well as in, for instance, in San Antonio, who would claim that they're more Hispanic, you know, they're more Spanish.
You really get a sense that this standard set by the treaty just completely scrambles people's identities, their allegiances to the past. It really forces them to strain the positions that they take.
Oh, exactly. No, exactly. And I think, you know, one of the things that I discovered in doing research for this book is that it would, you know, the treaty, specifically the war, but specifically the treaty, would come up over and over again in different civil rights campaigns for various things, from you know, campaigns against lynchings, you know, to campaigns for to reclaim property, to obtain electoral, you know, reforms. It would come up because of the promises of, you know, U.S. citizenship in the treaty.
But then at the same time, it's complicating allegiances, right? Because if you're going to emphasize your whiteness, mm-hmm. how do you form allegiances with other groups that might be subject to some of the same violence and hostility?
Exactly. And so, but what I do want to emphasize here is that you're right. So this sort of claim to whiteness, right, occurs over several generations and in various groups, in various civil rights groups of Mexican Americans, for example, LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens. They're going to emphasize their whiteness, but it doesn't mean that all members of LULAC are doing this, right? Some of them very explicitly recognize that they're mestizo, that they have indigenous ancestry. But it also means that not all civil rights groups do this. So there are several working class groups that don't necessarily make a claim to whiteness. They do say, why aren't our U.S. citizenship, why isn't the U.S. Acknowledging that we're U.S. citizens and respecting that, you know, we have certain rights and then enforcing those rights.
So, but if you look at the case of well, in the case of New Mexico, you have a concentration of former Mexican people. Then they're trying to make the case for statehood, emphasizing their whiteness, selectively remembering their past as a way to get there. But then if you take other regions like California and Texas, there it seems to be the opposite, where you get overrun by European Americans, the situation is very different. Your relationship to the past, maybe you've got to anchor yourself to other reference points to contend with a different situation.
Sure, I think you're pointing out sort of the demographic differences in these regions. So in New Mexico, more so than in Arizona, once they're split up, right, into different territories and then different states. But in New Mexico, you're going to have a Mexican American population that numerically, along with the Native American population, remains the majority there. And because of that, and it varies also according to the region, whether it's northern New Mexico or southern New Mexico, where the where Mexican Americans remain a numerical majority, they are oftentimes, it's easier for them to obtain political positions, right? Elected positions, local elected positions. And it's also perhaps easier for them to retain parts of their land, parts of their property. The same occurs in California and California and Texas. But in California and Texas, in California because of the gold rush, in Texas because part of Texas, what today is the state of Texas, had already split off, right, from Mexico in 1836 with the Republic of Texas, there's a huge influx of European Americans in Texas that pretty much makes Mexican Americans a distinct minority, a numerical minority, in most regions of Texas, except for southern Texas along the border and the El Paso region. And in California, you know, in northern California, they become a numerical majority much quicker because that's where most of the gold rush immigrants are arriving to. And in southern California, it varies also, say, for example, in Santa Barbara or Los Angeles, but they hold on to power a little bit longer into the 19th century because of their numbers.
Okay, so if you take a Francisco Ramirez, who is running this newspaper, he's really speaking out against all that happens with the influx of European Americans into California, the ways in which it creates tensions with existing landholders or conflicts between workers.
Yes, it's a fascinating story. That of Francisco Ramirez. So Francisco Ramirez was the editor and publisher of this newspaper, Spanish language newspaper in Los Angeles called El Clamor Público. And he began publishing this newspaper in 1855 when Ramirez was only 17 years old. And when I discovered this, I just thought it was such an amazing story. You know, Ramirez was fluent in Spanish and French and English, and he had actually been working had experience working at three other newspapers since he was 14 years old. So he was this incredibly, gifted intellectual, right? And so here when the U.S. takes over California, initially he sort of believes in cooperation between white Americans, citizens, and Mexican Americans. And he actually urges Mexican Americans to learn English, to become familiar with U.S. laws, to vote. And he believes very strongly in the U.S. Constitution, in the promises of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. But soon enough, you know, his optimism starts waning, starts decreasing, because in the 1850s, you know, you start seeing some of the effects, the human consequences of the war, which is that, you know, in Northern California, Mexican-Americans, as well as Chilean immigrants who ended up arriving for the Gold Rush, start experiencing harassment, intimidation, lynchings as European-Americans, as white Americans enter the mines and sort of drive them from the mines. In other places in Southern California and Northern California as well, but in other places, the landed elite, the California elite, Mexican-Americans who live in California, who had large amounts of property because they had obtained that property from the Mexican government as sort of reward for their military or political service, they start losing this land just like they do in New Mexico and Texas, because many of these landowners have to certify their land titles in U.S. courts. And what happens is many times U.S. Trained lawyers, English-speaking lawyers, will demand that these landowners pay them for, you know, certifying their land titles, but not pay them with money, but instead pay them with portions of their land. So even though they might have, you know, X amount of property that they then get, you know, title to, they end up losing part of that land to the lawyers as payment for, you know, their legal services. So that happens. And Francisco Ramirez discusses this in the newspaper. He describes this loss, this property loss, and he describes how unfair it is. And he refers to the treaty repeatedly and says, you know, we were promised that our property rights would be respected, and this isn't happening, right? This long process of confirming the land titles means that many times landowners are broke by the time they actually get their land titles confirmed. But he also addresses the persecution of working class Latinos, and in particular the lynching that goes on. And he coins a term that I was surprised, you know, about the term. I was surprised about the whole sort of phenomenon of lynching that happened that early on when I learned about it. So during the Gold Rush and in subsequent years, Mexican Americans are subject to lynching, and so, you know, for all sorts of reasons, you know, their vigilantes are trying to drive them from the mines, they're trying to drive them from their property. And so Ramirez comes up with this term in Spanish that he creates called linchocracia, which basically it's translated as lynchocracy. And it's a term that sort of combines lynching and democracy, and to describe what he believes is a democracy based on lynching. And obviously this is from a Mexican-American perspective, right? And so he criticizes, you know, the failure of state and local as well as federal governments to enforce the treaty. And so in the end, you know, his editorials often, you know, describe the Treaty Guadalupe Hidalgo. He denounces the fact that Mexican Americans are denied their civil rights. He urges his readers to learn more about U.S. laws, to learn English, and to vote to try to, you know, maintain political power. So I believe, you know, and many scholars who studied him believe that he's very significant, because even though his newspaper only lasted for 5 years, and, you know, his activism was continued by other journalists, you know, throughout the U.S. Southwest in terms of trying to advocate for Mexican-American civil rights. But more importantly, you know, his activism left a sort of a documentary record, right? That there were people who understood their rights, who were fighting for their rights, and who were trying to inform others, other Mexican-Americans, of their rights.
And you mentioned in other cases, there were people who organized rebellions, you know, armed resistance to what was happening. This seems to be the case of Cortina, and there's this Juan Cortina, and there's just a lasting memory of this rebellion that stretches all the way into the 20th century.
Yes. So Juan Cortina came from this sort of land grant family in South Texas, in the region today that we, you know, where Brownsville is located, Brownsville, Texas, at the southern tip. His ancestors were basically military officials and political officials who first established the Spanish towns called the Villas del Norte, or the northern towns, along the Rio Grande, on both sides of the Rio Grande, right near the mouth of the river, in the mid-18th century. So he lived in this, in what would become this Cameron County, and in that county, Tejanos are the majority of the population, were the majority of the population throughout the 19th century. And his family in the 1850s seemed to be starting to be integrated into local society under U.S. rule. He had several brothers. One of them was a merchant, had been elected to various offices. His younger brother was a tax collector, had run for tax collector, and Cortina had helped him run for tax collector. Juan Cortina had helped other European American politicians run for office by sort of advocating among Tejanos to vote for these politicians. So, you know, everything seemed to be indicating that, you know, he was being integrated, or his family was being integrated into this sort of new U.S. society, right, under U.S. rule. And yet, under this sort of, like I would say, a veneer of accommodation, there was some tension, because the Cortina family, his mother in particular, had lost a lot of land to lawyers who asked for payment in land to confirm their land titles in U.S. courts. And he had witnessed this among his family, and he had witnessed this among other friends who were, you know, part of the landed elite. And all this sort of, you know, this underlying tension basically came to a head when Cortina witnessed a sort of an incident of what we would call today law enforcement abuse or police brutality. In July of 1859, Cortina witnessed a Brownsville marshal, a European American, pistol whipping a Tejano worker. And so, Cortina tries to intervene and tells him to stop. And the marshal responds by insulting him and just ignoring, you know, his plea to stop. And so Cortina shoots the marshal, rescues the worker, and rides out of town on his horse. You know, very sort of like a movie kind of set. You know, it's a like an old Western, right? And several months later, Cortina leads a group of Tejanos and Mexican nationals who were celebrating Mexican independence in Matamoros over the border, and they take over Brownsville. They take over the city of Brownsville, which is, you know, a U.S. city, a Texas city, and they release prisoners from the jails. And they also shoot several European Americans who had been accused of killing or abusing Tejanos, but had not been punished. And this was the beginning of a 6-month rebellion that the Cortinistas, or those who follow Cortina, lead. And during this six-month rebellion, they issue a set of proclamations, several proclamations or statements explaining why they're rebelling. And in these proclamations, they're very important to me and to my research and to other researchers, other historians, because they detail, they have a list of all the abuses that Tejanos are suffering, from increased criminalization of some of their activities, like, you know, the fact that local cities pass laws curtailing, you know, fandangos or certain dances, curtailing certain Mexican cultural practices like cockfighting and such. The fact that Mexican or Tejanos are penalized more with jail time than European Americans for the same crime. Many of the crimes at the time were involving cattle, stealing cattle. So when Mexican Americans are found guilty of these crimes, they're sentenced to longer sentences in jail than European Americans who are found guilty of the same crime. They're also suspected of more crimes in general. You know, in the newspapers, there's all these stories about, you know, bandits or criminals, and most of the time, these newspapers just accuse, you know, Mexican Americans of the crime, even though they have very little proof. And so, in the proclamations, the Cortenistas remind, you know, their readers that the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo guaranteed that they would have U.S. citizenship and those rights, and they describe that these rights never were enforced, and they describe the Tejanos community's disappointment. And so the story of Cortina is covered not only in their proclamations, right, of the rebellion, not only in the proclamations explain them, but local newspapers, Spanish and English language newspapers on both sides of the border describe the Cortina rebellion, as well as there's congressional hearings, because what ends up happening is the Texas Rangers are called in, as well as the U.S. Army, to suppress the rebellion, and they do so after 6 months. But the story, you know, the rebellion and the demands that the Cortenistas made are going to live on for future generations, because they're published in these proclamations, and these proclamations are then archived in, you know, in U.S. Archives, as well as republished in the congressional hearings, as well as in newspapers. And so these, you know, the demands they made, and the fact that it was only 11 years after the end of the war, it was from 1848 is when the war ended, in 1859 is when this rebellion occurred, they were already, describing that Tejanos are disappointed in the lack of enforcement of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. And this was a specific case, you know, it's a specifically unique case, because it was an armed rebellion, and there weren't as many armed rebellions, you know, throughout the U.S. Southwest. There were some in New Mexico, and there were some in California, but I don't think there was as many that lasted as long as the one that Cortina led.
And my sense is that the memories surrounding Cortina are very much contested, right? And there's a positive memory that's kept alive within the Mexican American community. And if you fast forward to the second generation, you know, 30 years on, that they're trying to already early on, they're trying to challenge the way he's been cast in a negative light.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And, you know, this happens in various generations, but his descendants, as well as other Tejanos, believe that, you know, in many ways they see him as someone who stood up for their rights, right? Whereas English language newspapers in Texas and elsewhere describe him as a bandit, you know, mainly as a bandit. And he eventually ends up leaving, you know, Texas, and ends up in Mexico, and becomes a military leader there. And he also becomes involved in U.S. politics or U.S. military confrontations during the U.S. Civil War as well. But that's another story. But he is seen in a very negative light by English language readers and English language journalists for most of the 19th century. And it's not until the 20th century that some of his descendants actually write, you know, essays and, you know, books that seek to reclaim, you know, his sort of version of history and place him in a more positive light.
So one of the points that you make throughout your book is that memory is flowing in both directions across the world. You have memories within the Mexican-American community. You've got immigrants that bring memories with them. You have newspapers on the U.S. side of the border that may transmit memories to the Mexican side, and newspapers on the Mexican side that transmit memories to the American side. Is that they're flowing in different directions. And once you start to be removed in time from the actual event of the U.S.-Mexican War, you need these memory flows to keep the memory alive. And I think you talk about this with the second generation. You have an effort to kind of borrow from sources in Mexico to remind people of what happened during the war.
Yes, exactly. One of the things I try to I point out is obviously the first generation lived through the war, so their memories are going to be personal memories. But the second generation, right, those who are active and, you know, come of age in the 1880s and beyond, and then the third generation and so forth, they're not going to have experienced the war directly, right? But they're going to learn about the war, learn about its consequences, learn about the treaty from, you know, their family. And they're also going to learn, you know, newspapers and from immigrants who come from Mexico and so forth. So I describe an incident in Southern California where this newspaper in Santa Barbara is republishing stories that they obtain from Mexican newspapers. And in Mexico, in the late 19th century, there are various newspapers that are describing the battles that occurred during the U.S.-Mexican War, that are, you know, describing what happened in the past, and also describing how the war ended, how the Mexico lost lots of territory. They describe the promises in the treaty, and all of this is picked up by newspapers in this particular case that I describe, a newspaper in California, in Santa Barbara, and, you know, republished. And so in a way, I describe this as a transnational circulation of memories, a transnational circulation of collective memory, in that, you know, Mexican Americans living in Santa Barbara, living throughout Southern California, because the newspapers extends beyond the city. They're going to learn about Mexico's version of events, not only through their family, not only through their friends, not only through Mexican immigrants, but also through newspapers that are republishing, you know, these events that are initially published in Mexico. So that's one of the ways I believe it occurs throughout the U.S. Southwest, but I just give specific examples of how certain newspapers along the border, or, you know, where in places like San Antonio also, or places like New Mexico, are learning, you know, the editors, the journalists are reading newspapers from Mexico and sometimes republishing their stories or their, you know, news stories in Mexico for Mexican newspapers. And so this, I believe, adds to the sort of transnational circulation of memories.
Okay, so if we fast forward to the third generation, seems like the major upheaval is this revolution,
right,
in Mexico, 1910 to 1920. You mentioned 1.5 million people come to the U.S. There's a huge demographic upheaval. And that's the time when your family came,
right,
originally to the U.S. And this really forces Mexican Americans to take a position towards immigration. And they do so in terms of their past. So what happens during this? How does the past come into play in terms of how they negotiate their response to immigration?
So once again, I would say it varies, right? It varies by region. I'll just point out a few things that happen. So Mexican Americans who have been living in Texas, New Mexico, and California, right, have, you know, they continue to have in many ways connections to Mexico, you know, by reading, you know, newspapers from Mexico, for example, by interacting with recent Mexican immigrants. The immigration the flow of Mexican immigrants into the U.S. begins with the war, right? In the immediate aftermath of the war in the 1850s and 60s, people are still coming over. But it accelerates during the last part of the 19th century when there's a dictator in Mexico named Porfirio Díaz, who has policies that basically create lots of landlessness. He favors wealthy landowners. He favors foreign investment. So there's workers who are replaced or displaced from their jobs, I should say. And many times they eventually migrate to other cities in Mexico, but eventually end up migrating to the U.S. And then this all accelerates tremendously, as you mentioned, with the Mexican Revolution, which is an internal civil war in Mexico that lasts, it's basically from the 1910 until 1921. And during that period, there's a huge flood of Mexican immigrants into the U.S. And they're going to come mainly into states where there's a large Mexican-American population, right? So the U.S. southwestern states. And what happens, how the Mexican-American community reacts varies by class, by region, and so forth. But among the issues that occur are that, you know, these Mexican immigrants are going to necessarily, you know, find homes and find employment among other Mexican Americans, right? Of people that look like them, but that, you know, have been here in the U.S. longer. And that creates, in some cases, competition, and it creates resentment in some cases because they're competing for the same jobs, they're competing for the same housing and such. And so there's some friction. Not all Mexican Americans are going to be opposed to these Mexican immigrants, but some are. But in other cases, among sort of more middle class or wealthy Mexican Americans, they are going to, in some cases, have a very negative view, not because they're competing with you know, these displaced workers, because the workers who are arriving, many of them are working class, right? But because their presence in the U.S. Is sort of tarnishes, in their view, their standing among European Americans. So the sort of prime example that people give is this organization called the League of United Latin American Citizens that began in South Texas, and it's called LULAC. It's similar, I would say, in some ways to the NAACP, right? It's composed of mainly educated middle class professionals, doctors, lawyers, and, you know, business owners and such. And they see themselves as leaders, you know, in the NAACP case, you know, like the talented 10th, that idea that is going to lead their community. Well, in LULAC's case, they don't necessarily use this idea of the talented 10th, but they do see themselves as leaders. Well, they, from their formation, they decide that they're only going to be an organization of U.S. citizens. So they're not going to have Mexican immigrants among them. They're not going to allow Mexican immigrants into membership in their organization, because they feel that only U.S. citizens have a vote. Only U.S. citizens have sort of the power to influence the Mexican American community by voting and by being involved, civically. And so they expel Mexican immigrants who initially wanted to join. They expel them from the organization. But they also expel them, not just for this sort of political reasons, but they expel them because they feel, and they try to distance themselves. Now, not all LULAC members, but the majority are going to try to distance themselves from Mexican immigrants because they believe that Mexican immigrants who are coming into the U.S. are poor, are sometimes, you know, not fluent in English, that they're going to give Mexican Americans a bad image among European Americans. Because these, you know, and this happens with all immigrant groups, right? That the more recent immigrants are going to be looked down upon, scorned by those immigrants who have arrived here earlier, or in the case of Mexican Americans, you know, people who had been here, who had born in the U.S., but had ties to Mexico, but don't want to be associated with recent arrivals.
But you also point out that there's a reading of the past, right? There's a kind of fantasy understanding of the past that where there was this peaceful, or there was a peaceful coexistence between communities, and the problem was that European Americans didn't really understand that history. That there was some educational work, right, that had to be done. You had to remind people the contributions that were made by Mexican Americans in Texas, and then you could somehow return to that past.
Yes, yes. This is another instance of sort of selective remembering, right? So Mexican Americans, for instance, in LULAC, some of them describe this sort of idyllic past where Mexican Americans in Texas and Anglo Americans in Texas got along, and that they don't emphasize any conflict. Which, when in reality, there was lots of conflict, and just like in, you know, other parts of the Southwest. But the LULAC members who have espoused this view, the reason they espouse this view is because they're seeking accommodation. They're seeking to have alliances with Anglo-Americans, right? And they believe the best way of doing that is by de-emphasizing conflict and emphasizing cooperation. They want to emphasize, for example, that Tejanos took part in the Texas independence movement, that Tejanos, allied with Anglo-American politicians and so forth, and that they served in the military, in various military, in World War I, World War II, and so forth by the 1940s and 50s. And so they're super focused on emphasizing U.S., the patriotism that Mexican Americans have exhibited
Is this the same time that Tejanos are getting involved in commemorating places like the Alamo?
Yes, exactly. In the early 19th century, early 20th century. Yes, there's another group of Mexican Americans who are sort of involved in so-called rescuing the Alamo from development, and in trying to emphasize that Tejanos were also involved in the separatist struggle, to establish the Republic of Texas.
And then you have this other organization, ANMA, that seems to go in the complete opposite direction when it's fighting on behalf of Mexican Americans.
Right. So ANMA is sort of the political wing. It began as a political wing of a union, of a labor union, and they become a civil rights organization. They have chapters throughout the U.S. Southwest, and they are more critical of U.S. policies and how the Mexican American experience in the U.S. than LULAC is. They believe that they look at the U.S.-Mexican War, and they believe it was a war of conquest, it was an invasion, and that the problems that have afflicted Mexican American communities since the mid-19th century are a result of the war and a result of the fact that the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was never enforced. So they take a very different stance. They're more working class, a much more politically progressive organization. And so they don't sort of idealize the past in any way. They selectively remember as well, but they remember the way they sort of use the war memories and the memories of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo is to press for civil rights reform and say we need to be united, as organizations, as Mexican American communities, and press for the rights that were promised to us because they were never enforced.
So when you get to the 1960s and the 1970s, that's the period where we tend to think that's the era of civil rights activism, and you point out, no, this really goes back to the middle of the 19th century. There's a much older history, but if you're looking at these Chicano civil rights activists fighting against the history of dispossession, things that were being denounced for decades and decades, or the Brown Berets, and they're embarking on these different marches to try to sensitize people about past injustices, or to try to challenge the memory of individuals like a Cortina. This, to me, seems like it's more of a carryover from the work of ANMA. It seems to be much more in line with a more militant spirit, a sense of cultural pride. That you find maybe in ANMA and a lot less and more of a departure, I guess, from the work of LULAC.
Yes, exactly. However, I'll start by saying that there are certain civil rights organizations that still continue this sort of more accommodationist approach. LULAC is one of them. They're still around. They're still around today, right? And they continue to sort of emphasize their patriotism and emphasize, accommodation and emphasize alliances. And they continue up until a point, late in the 20th century to exclude immigrants. Today they're much more progressive than they were in the past. But ANMA does have this sort of more militant and more critical view of Mexican American experience and their rights and their the way that Mexican Americans have been allowed to exercise their civil rights. And I would say, yes, that organizations that came out of the 70s, like the various student organizations in universities and in high schools, as well as the Brown Berets, who modeled themselves after the Black Panthers, are definitely sort of continuing in the tradition, sort of the militant and oppositional tradition of ANMA and other working class organizations like mutual aid societies and such, who had a much more critical view of the Mexican-American experience in the U.S. And one of the things that I found sort of fascinating about the Brown Berets, for example, is that they specifically challenge not just the sort of the history of, you know, of the U.S.-Mexico War and how it's presented. And, you know, many of them are Mexican-Americans. Some of them are Mexican immigrants. They're influenced by, you know, this collective memory of the war that has been passed on through, you know, over generations by through family, friends, from other Mexican immigrants, from, you know, newspapers, from books and such. But one of the things they do is they stage a march. Initially, they stage a march from Southern California to Northern California to Sacramento. And then when that march is successful, they end up going, extending the march throughout the U.S. Southwest. And their march is called La Marcha de la Reconquista, or the March of the Reconquest. And they're not referring to a physical or actual reconquest of the lands that used to belong to Mexico, but instead they're referring to this idea of reconquering the memory and reconquering the ideas, you know, of that they were promised civil rights by the treaty, and that those were never those rights were never enforced. And they want, you know, Mexican Americans to be aware that they had certain rights, and that those rights were denied, and that this all began with the U.S.-Mexican War, you know, with the second class citizenship that the first and subsequent generations had to endure. So one of the things that I found fascinating about the Brown Berets is that as they traveled across the U.S. Southwest, they would learn, they would, you know, talk to communities, you know, in different towns in Arizona and New Mexico and Texas, and learn about local issues, like what's going on, what are the issues that you're involved with that you're trying to, you know, generate support for. And they would help them. And sometimes they would also erect monuments, monuments to certain Mexican-American heroes, where it was Joaquin Murrieta, and who was a so-called social bandit in California. They erected a monument to him in Arizona at a public park that the local Mexican-American community wanted to rename after Joaquin Murrieta. They would also carry the Mexican flag as they marched through different towns. And then they would erect, you know, monuments in Texas to Juan Cortina, because like them, like the Brown Berets, Cortina had been very interested in the criminalization and of Mexican Americans, as well as the police abuse of Mexican Americans. The Brown Berets were similarly concerned with this. And so I found it fascinating because that they erected these monuments, and the monuments didn't last, you know, the local authorities would destroy them afterwards and remove them. But what I thought was fascinating was that the Brown Berets were challenging sort of the public history that was being presented, and the absence of Mexican-American heroes in these public commemorations, in these public monuments. So they were sort of bringing their own history and saying, we need a monument to Juan Cortina, we need a monument to Joaquin Murrieta, and we need to remember that this land used to belong to Mexico.
Again, they're contesting histories that, again, as late as the 1970s, they're still not being taught in schools, right? They're still not in the textbooks.
Exactly, yes. And many of them, the Brown Berets, as well as other Chicano movement activists, they describe in their memoirs or in letters that they didn't find out many times about what happened during the war until they were in college, or until they were in high school, and a certain teacher explained, like, "Oh, California used to belong to Mexico." And then the student would then go ask their parents, "Is this true?" And the parents would say, "Yes." And there would be this other, another sort of transmission of collective memories of the war, but as a result of something they learned in school, because it wasn't taught necessarily, in elementary or middle school.
So if you turn to the political present and with the lead up to the presidential elections, the border, issues of the border could not be more front and center. And what's your personal opinion on this? The ways in which the border gets politicized, does this really hinge on just a forgetting of this history that you tell?
Yes. My simple answer is yes, it does hinge on that. I mean, one of the things that we've seen in, you know, politicians and sort of some media accounts of what's going on is the conservative media, conservative politicians describe this invasion, right, of Latinos, of this invasion of our southern border. And I should first point out that many times when politicians or journalists refer to the border, the U.S.-Mexico border, they just say the border. And, you know, you could ask yourself, well, are they talking about the U.S.-Canadian border or the U.S.-Mexico border? But everyone sort of knows that they're talking about the U.S.-Mexico border. But that's, it's sort of weird that they just use this term, the border, and everyone knows what border they're talking about. The other thing is that they, you know, in this discussion that where they talk about invasion, they selectively leave out that, you know, this land, you know, used to belong to Mexico. This land was taken over in a war of conquest. I mean, the former Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, you know, several months ago was criticized, you know, and I think, you know, correctly for saying something about, you know, I think he was referring to the Russian invasion of the Russian war against Ukraine and saying, you know, the U.S. has never taken territory as a result of a war. And, you know, he represents a district in California, or he represented at the time a district in California that had been part of Mexico, right? So he, you know, the land that he represented in California was actually part of Mexico, and it was actually taken by the U.S. as a result of the U.S. and Mexico war. So this selective forgetting is, you know, common among not just the media, but politicians, even who should know better and who I think do know better, but they're just choosing to forget or selectively forget that this land used to be Mexican. The other thing I would emphasize is that sometimes in this rhetoric of, you know, that we're being invaded, it has very harmful consequences, you know, because Mexican Americans today or other Latinos are seen as the other, even though they might have lived here for generations. They might have lived here, you know, their ancestors might have lived in New Mexico or Texas or California since before the U.S. took over. But because they look similar to other Latino immigrants, right? Because they have Spanish surnames, they're going to be seen as other, as recent immigrants. And you know, that's the sort of the conundrum that various civil rights organizations like LULAC have been dealing with for a long time, right? Some of them didn't want to be associated with recent immigrants because there was this hostility toward recent immigrants. So they tried to distance themselves. So today, this is still going on. Not necessarily the distancing. I mean, that does happen. But the association of recent immigrants, recent Mexican or Latino immigrants, to Mexican Americans or other Latino Americans. And I think that's very harmful. And we see this as, you know, the direct effects of this harm. And, you know, several years ago, there was a shooting in El Paso at a Walmart in El Paso by a gunman who, in his sort of statements, in his written statements about why he was doing what he was doing, said that he was trying to stop the invasion that was occurring along the southern border. And I think that's just really harmful and detrimental rhetoric that I think politicians use to shore up votes, to shore up support, to fundraise, but it has very detrimental consequences to Latinos in the U.S.
Omar, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for this opportunity. I really enjoyed speaking about my book, and I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Omar Valerio Jimenez is a professor of history at the University of Texas, San Antonio. I've been talking with him today about his book, Remembering Conquest, Mexican Americans, Memory, and Citizenship. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend or review us on your favorite podcast app. I'm Rick Dedarian. See you soon.